Winter Star Party with Mark Radici on episode 409 of the Actual Astronomy Podcast. I'm Chris, and joining me is Shane. We are amateur astronomers who love looking up in the night sky. And this podcast is for everybody who likes going out under the stars. I'll read a quick bio first, and then we will hop into things. Mark Radici is a longtime amateur astronomer, having begun his observing career with the comet Hayakutake back in 1996. During that time, he was working in Canada. Mark returned to the UK and eventually settled near the oldest observatory, Stonehenge. He had a roll-off roof observatory constructed for his own use, and that's where he drinks tea, observes sketches, and creates YouTube videos for his Refreshing Views YouTube channel. Mark was recently in Florida for the Winter Star Party. Welcome back to the show, Mark. Great to have you.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Yeah, good, Mark. Good to see you again.
Yeah.
Happy St. Patrick's.
I left the tropical weather back in Florida. It's very grey and wet over in England at the moment, so I'm already missing those warm southern skies.
Yeah, same here. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We're recording this on St. Patrick's Day.
Of course, yeah. So we've got to celebrate in England because the England rugby team actually played well for once and actually beat Ireland, who are sort of rated number one team in the world. So we're very happy with that. But then Ireland then went and won the Six Nations Championship, so they're very happy. They'll be having a good day today in Ireland. I suppose for your American listeners, then you'll have to explain that this is a sport where other countries play each other rather than just a World Series against other worlds.
I think St. Patrick was from Cambria or something. I think he was actually from the UK originally, so yeah, this is fitting.
Yeah, something like that, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Florida was good, really good. We've had such a grey, sort of wet winter in the UK, you know, and I look forward to that week out in Florida. So I fly out with my telescope, stay overnight at the airport hotel in Miami, have a look at the moon, have a look at the morning planets when I'm out there, and then, yeah, drive on down over the bridge. It's about 2 or 3 hours drive south of Miami. And in my hand, like if I just share my pictures with you, that should come through to you now. So I've got my little 90 millimeter refractor, which I take in my hand luggage. So I've got the telescope, my binoculars, eyepieces, camera, all that sort of stuff goes with me in my hand luggage. So I can put that in the cabin as carry on. And then I've got a sort of lightweight carbon fiber tripod. That all goes in the hold. And then I've got one of the Altaz, Skywatcher Altaz mounts. That's really light. So I've got tracking. So I've got that in, that goes in the hold, the mount goes in the hold, and then the delicate optics come with me in the cabin. And as you can see there in that picture I'm sharing with you, you know, you've got looking south over the sea, over the Caribbean. Yeah, you know, the next source of light pollution to the south is Havana, which is about 90 kilometers over the sea.
Nice.
And so the first night I get there, and it happens every year, the first night I get there, of course, you're looking up at the beautiful night sky, all the constellations are in the wrong place. So Orion is now really high, the Ursa Major and the Pleiades, they're really low, and there's constellations underneath Orion, you know, like Eridanus and, Puppis, they're sort of hovering around the horizon back here up in England, and suddenly they're really high. Canopus, the second brightest star in the night sky, you know, that's really high, so they all sort of move up one, you know. So Canopus is where Sirius is, Sirius is where Jupiter is, and Jupiter's nearly overhead at this point, so it is rather nice. So I have to turn to new pages in my star atlas, pages that I don't really use very often. I use for about a week a year as I hunt around for new exotic objects. It was really good, really good. Shame to come back.
So how's the, you're using the Skywatcher AZ GTI, how's that working for you?
Yeah, it's good. It's a lightweight mount. It's very affordable. It was about £250, so I don't know what that works out at in dollars. So it's quite an affordable mount. So it's go-to in tracking. The telescope that which I've got there is the 90 millimeter Megray, so it's a second-hand refractor, and that's very much on its limit. You couldn't put a bigger, heavier telescope on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you wanted to upgrade your telescope with time, but I think it's actually quite a nice little mount. It's certainly very affordable, and it does what it says on the tin. You know, it go-tos and it tracks,
mm-hmm.
So you can just dial up targets off its slews, and you then, you know, you can track. Obviously, it's Altazimuth. You can get wedges. So you can track equatorially, but no, I quite liked it. It's light, it's easy, and obviously if I'm putting it in my hand luggage, sorry, putting it in the cabin luggage to go in the hold, then obviously weight becomes quite a concern.
So it's good. What is the total weight of that setup, Mark?
5, maybe 8 kilos. What's that, 16 pounds, something like that. The okay. telescope must be 5 kilos with the finder and the tube rings and the diagonal. The tripod, couple of kilos or something like carbon fiber tripod, and the head itself is only a kilo. The actual head itself, the GTI. So, in terms of lightweight setup, I don't think you can get much lighter.
Yeah, and it looks like you have a camera on there. So you were doing a little astrophotography, I assume.
Yeah, I don't. I there's always, when you read on clouds and lights, isn't there? There's the big battle between the sort of visual traditional observers and the images, and they seem to be two very separate camps. And I try not to get drawn into that battle. What I'm really got into is doing that live stacking. So I've got the camera in the telescope there, and what that does is it's taking, say, 10-second exposures. And so I've got my laptop behind me, and that's in a little screened enclosure. And then the software that you can get, affordable software called SharpCap, that stacks the images one on top of the other. So in, 60 seconds, I've now stacked 6 10-second exposures. So in effect, I've turned my 90-millimeter refractor, I don't know, into a 20-inch telescope. I can resolve spiral arms, star clouds and galaxies, details inside the Horsehead Nebula. So it is rather pleasant. And I started actually sketching it. So it's a bit weird. I've got the camera set up, tracking. I've got the telescope tracking. I've got the camera stacking. And yet I will sketch what I can see on the laptop screen, which I stupidly haven't brought down with me, my notebook. I was going to show you those as well. So I can actually sketch the view. So I keep on saying this is the best eyepiece I've ever bought. And it turns my telescope into this 90-millimeter refractor, one that I take in my hand luggage on an aircraft. And yet, so looking at something like M83, for example, you can resolve, star clouds in the galaxy with a 90-millimeter refractor. So I think it's brilliant. It's turned my little telescope into a huge telescope. But you'll like this one as well. This is quite cool as well. So that's me in front of a 32-inch Dob. It's a big
telescope. Yep.
It was rather. I don't think I could have got that in my hand luggage. That was the biggest telescope I had a look at. There are 24 inch and 28 inch. Sorry, and this was the biggest telescope, 32 inch, and it was amazing.
For a second, I thought that was snow on the ground, but it must be sand.
It's just the sand, the white sand, and the quartz, or whatever it is. But we saw the best thing we saw in that was, apart from looking at, say, the Whirlpool Galaxy, so you've got M51, the Whirlpool Galaxy, the spiral arms. It just looks like a photograph, in the eyepiece. See the spiral arms, and you can see the star clouds, the HD regions inside the spiral arms. And it's easy, you're not, trying to control your breathing and pick up all your night vision. It's just there. It's just obvious. And then he swung it over to M87, which is that massive elliptical galaxy right down in Virgo. And of course, it's got a relativistic jet. It's got that huge black hole. Do you remember the black hole telescope they used to capture the radio telescope?
Mm-hmm.
And with that 32-inch telescope, you could see the little jet coming off the nucleus. It was subtle. It wasn't an easy observation. So a bunch of us from our astronomy club here, we went, do you know Professor Brian Cox? He does the BBC show on the television about planets. So he gave a talk a few weeks ago near us. We all went to go and see him talk. And he was talking about black holes, relativistic jets, event horizons. I was going, oh, I've seen a relativistic jet.
Wow, that's incredible. What's the focal ratio on the 32-inch?
I think it's about f3.5, 4 or something like that. So it needed the paracore.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Yeah, to keep it in there. And you can see it's not that much taller. I'm 6 foot tall, and it's not that much taller than me.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty cool, pretty cool. And that's what I like about star parties, of course, is that you get to use equipment that you just don't. I don't have access to a 32-inch telescope, but the guy said, yeah, come and have a look. Yeah, of course, have a look. And he's just doing his observing, and he shared the views as well.
It's a Webster, I think. I would say
I'll take your word for it. Yeah, beautiful open truss telescope.
Mm-hmm. Does it track? Is there motors on?
You just see behind my knees there. You've got the motors there as well. So it's tracking and go to.
That's incredible. What was the eyepieces used in that telescope? Were they lower focal lengths?
Ethos is, yeah. I think you had the 20mm Ethos. That was his sort of workhorse eyepiece. And of course, because you've got a long focal length, just by the very nature of it being a 32-inch mirror, you know, you're sort of low power, wide angle eyepiece. That, you know, in our refractors, that's suddenly become a, you know, a sort of high power eyepiece just because of the very nature of the long focal length.
Did you get a look at M42 through it?
Oh, not through that one, but through the 28-inch. It becomes a bit routine, you know, the Orion Nebula. And of course, being out there, I want to see all the exotic southern stuff that I can't see from the UK. So I use the Orion Nebula for, you know, while you're getting ready, while you're getting used to the night vision and stuff. But, you know, being able to see Omega Centauri, they call it, their nickname for Omega Centauri is Oh My God Centauri, because it's so big. And I only found out some time ago, isn't it? It's classified as a globular cluster. But of course, they think it might be a core of a dwarf galaxy that's been gobbled up by the Milky Way. It's been cannibalized, lost all its outer dust and gas and stars and stuff. So you just got that core, that bright core. But it's not a globular. It's actually the core of a dwarf galaxy. So that was pretty cool. Eta Carina as well. That's a good one. Have you seen Eta Carina?
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yeah. That's much bigger, I thought, than the Orion Nebula, but surface brightness. That's the thing.
Yeah, it'd still be fairly low there, but yeah, it would come up probably about 5 or 6 degrees.
Yeah, something like that. So you could only see it on the clear nights, you know, when there's no mist or haze over the sea. So down near the horizon. Yeah, you know, it's low when your telescope's horizontal.
Yeah. How about the Southern Cross? Is it?
We saw that, and only a couple of times, but again, down on the horizon. And then, of course, you've got the jewel box as well, so that's pretty cool. And, of course, this stuff you just can't see from England. You know, it's way below the horizon. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, to see all this exotic southern stuff. But it is quite nice when you come home because it is a week. I say to people at work, you know, I'm going to Florida, and they go, are you taking the family? And I go, no, I'm going by myself. Just get a little bit of a laugh. And then I say, but I am spending a week, you know, camping, you know, at a campsite. So it is quite nice when you get home. You say, I can sleep in a bed and I don't have to walk 500 meters to go to the shower. You know, it is good.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about these types of trips is at the end, going home is kind of nice because you put up with a lot of discomfort and a lack of sleep and everything else. So getting back to a normal routine is nice, but it's certainly worth the sacrifice while you're there to be able to look through a 32-inch and, you know, to see some of the, some of the marquee objects of the Southern Hemisphere is, you know, for us Northern Hemisphere folks, that's quite a treat.
Yeah, no, it is good, isn't it? Well, I was trying to show you the picture of the Eta Carina. Oh, there it is. It's just suddenly come up. I mean, there's so much happening in this thing. You've got the Eta Carina itself, which is that bright star in the middle. And then you've got all the dust that's sort of blown off. You know, it's a star. Was it a Wolf Rayet star? It's about to go supernova. I mean, about as in sometime in the next 100,000 years. So it's puffing off all these outer shells, all this gas and dust inside. And then looking through the big scope, say the 24 or the 28-inch dobs that were nearby, you could actually see it looks like a little jelly baby, a little they call it the homunculus, a little sort of, it's like a little fetus or something inside it, which is the actual star itself. But it's all surrounded by these dust clouds and gas clouds, or it's all been pushed off. But you can see there, that's the sort of field of view you get through the telescope doing the live stacking. And then you can zoom in. So it's about a degree and a half across, you know, in color. Sorry, not in color, in full sort of digital. You know, so I sit there with my notebook, sketching away, you know, drinking my tea. You know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, happy days.
What kind of camera is that, Mark?
It's a black and white camera. It's from a company called Player One. Chinese companies. And actually, honestly, I find that they're all pretty much of a muchness, these cameras. So it's a 3,000 by 3,000 pixel camera for 533 chip. I don't understand at all how the numbering works in cameras. You'd think it would be like, whatever, you know, like cars, you know, the higher the number, the more horsepower you have, or the bigger the engine. Whereas cameras, they seem to just pick a random number generator for the performance. So it's a Player One Saturn M, which is based around a 533 chip, CMOS chip. And I literally just leave it on test neck and exposures, And it just, you know, takes 10 seconds. Every 10 seconds takes a fresh exposure, stacks one on top of the other. And the software then, so the signal then builds up. And of course, the noise averages out with time. And so, yeah, you get to resolve star clouds and dust clouds, you know, in nebula and galaxies, you know, across the Milky Way and across intergalactic space. One of the cool things was as well, there was the 28-inch scope. And the guy, Jim, who was observing through that, he was, you know, the Beehive star cluster in Cancer, you know, the M44 yep. Recipe. So you got this beautiful, you know, star cluster. And if you look at it through your telescope, you know, you can see all the stars around it. It's beautiful in binoculars. And of course, he was looking at it through his 28-inch telescope. And I said, Jim, you know, what are you doing looking through that? You know, you're just going to have like four stars in the field of view because you're sort of looking through the star cluster. And he goes, no, he says, I'm not looking at that. He says, I'm looking through the stars at the galaxies that are on the other side of the star cluster. So he was resolving distant galaxies through the Beehive.
That's amazing.
Same thing. I put the 90 mil across the red, and again, you can see little smudges. You know, and I think after a while, all galaxies become little smudges, don't they?
Yeah.
Pulling out 15th magnitude galaxies, 14th magnitude galaxies, and stuff. But he was doing it in the eyepiece, and I was doing it with a little telescope.
Yeah. So would 14 to 15 magnitude be the resolving limit of your 90 millimeter with the Player One camera?
I think you can go a little bit fainter. I mean, they're obvious. With that, but yeah, you can see sort of 16th, 17th magnitude stuff as well. But yeah, but obviously the more you leave it stacking, the deeper you can get up to a point.
That's really interesting. Yeah. You know, we've had some folks on in the past talk about using like the night vision, you know, attached to a telescope, which sort of increases your aperture in a way. So to hear you compare it in that regard, that, you know, turns your 90 millimeter into a 20 inch, I think is pretty cool.
I just find the stuff, hopefully the sound doesn't come across, but so something else. There you are. So there's the Beehive. And yeah, there you are. So you're resolving all the galaxies in the NGC 2643. So you can see all the bright stars that are in the Beehive galaxy cluster as I move the screen around. Magnitude 16, IC2388. And that's after 55 seconds of exposure. I can sit there with my notebook. You know, I've got my cup of tea on the table in my little travel mug with the lid on. And I can, sketch the stars, put the little smudges in for the galaxies. So this was brilliant fun. And of course, when I'm back home, you know, if my wife and children are in bed, you know, being out, having to, I sort of feel guilty if I stay up too late. But of course, going to a star party means you can stay up all night. So I immerse myself in all the stuff I can't see from the UK and just enjoy the stuff, you know, because we can stay up, so, you know, all night.
What's the, like with the mount that you're using, the AZ GTI, what's the longest exposure time you can go with before you start to notice maybe the tracking, you know, not quite being as precise as needed for like very long exposure?
So I like to keep it simple. I think in astronomy is a hobby, isn't it? And the purpose of astronomy is to enjoy the beauty of the night sky. So in my opinion, and other people's opinions will vary, I like to keep it simple. So I don't worry about guiding. I don't do flats. I don't do darks. But I do 10 seconds exposures and let them just run, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. And 20 or 30 minutes, I find I'm ready to move to another target. You know, I've done my sketch. I've enjoyed looking at what I'm doing. Right, let's go look at something else. And you do get what you call the image rotation. So, of course, I'm tracking out azimuthly. So I'm going up, down, left, right as we track across the sky. Whereas, of course, an equatorial telescope is tracking what's the word I'm looking for. So, you know, there's no image rotation. It's tracking parallel to the Earth's rotation. So you get the sort of distorted sort of parallelogram effect as the field of view has rotated as the telescopes remain parallel with the horizon. So 20, 30 minutes, I find is about right for me. You know, you've lost the corners as the image has rotated, but I'm ready to move on at that point anyway. So that works out well. So for a lightweight, cheap, easy setup, portable, put it in your suitcase, go to another country, that little GTI with a refractor, you know, being able to resolve what we have there, magnitude 15, magnitude 16 galaxies through the stars in the Beehive was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a great endorsement for that type of setup. You know, to be able to, you know, pick up those photons is really quite outstanding to me. Yeah, very, very cool.
And you'll like this one as well. So sorry, go on, Chris. Sorry, I
I was
talked
just
across
going to
you.
ask if you have scanned in or taken photos of any of the sketches that you did of the like at a Etta-Crene or any of this stuff.
I haven't done yet. We're crazy busy at work at the moment. I don't know what it's like in your part of the world, but I'm working for a company, and the company does some work for the Ministry of Defence. So we've got the joys of our end of financial year deliverables. So they're all crazy busy trying to spend the last of their budget, which therefore they're trying to pass on to us. So we've got loads of stuff to do. So Easter leave, I've booked off the week for Easter. So that's the time to catch up with my sketches, catch up with all the observations, and start putting that all together.
Nice.
And
How
I think
many?
I've also realized that I actually quite enjoy doing astronomy. And the next day I go, I can't be bothered to write it up. I like being outside under the stars. And the next day it just feels like work to then process and write up and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, Ken. How are you doing your sketches? Are you just using like the graphite on white paper or?
Yeah, I've experimented because Mary, you interviewed Mary, didn't you, a year or
Mary
two ago, didn't
McIntyre,
you?
yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so she got me doing the white pencils on black background. But just for simplicity, I've just gone for graphite pencils, ordinary graphite pencils. So I use a mechanical propelling pencil to do the stars because, of course, if it's a propelling pencil, it's always sharp. So I'll mark the stars in. And then I'll use a 2H pencil, so a lighter pencil, gentle pencil, and then mark in the nebulosity, and then use a blending stump to sort of smooth out the details. And I find the funny thing is, of course, because you've got your photograph on one onto your laptop, and you've got your picture on there, and you go, "Well, it kind of looks like it, a bit like a sort of, I don't know, a Picasso, like a Guernica." Sort of sketchy thing. I can kind of see what you're seeing there, but it doesn't quite look the same. But it's good. And the funny thing, being able to resolve all this stuff, you actually say, I've seen that all through the power of the camera, seen that stuff on the screen.
At the star party, were there many talks or anything of that nature?
Yeah, so they had daily talks. There was also secondhand, bring and buy sales, so people were selling gear as well. And of course, you've got the trade stands as well. So there's vendors coming along as well. So it was really good. And that's the nice thing about it, of course, is that you've got that stuff, that astronomy theme during the day. They hire from the next island up is a nature reserve. So they hired the ranger, the guy did the nature talk, and they did the walk along the beach. So you get to see all the flora and the fauna, all the interesting stuff. So
Cool.
yeah, it's plenty to do during the day as well.
I can't remember if you told us this before, Mark, because I think we've talked about the Winter Star Party on a previous episode with you, but what do you do for food? Is there restaurants or, you know, as somebody that would
Yeah,
be
so
traveling
yeah,
there?
Southern Florida. Yes, yeah, it's a pretty touristy part of the world. I was amazed when I went. I didn't realize how busy it is. And then, you talk to people out there and you realize how cold and bleak it is up in your part of the world. And that's why they all fly to Florida. See, we just get gray and wet, whereas, of course, you get very cold and, harsh winters. So, yes, there's people there who've driven. I mean, one guy talks, I think he came from Montreal. And he was saying, however cold it was, minus 20 Celsius or something like that. But I was saying that, I jump in a plane, I have a gin and tonic, watch a movie, another gin and tonic, bite to eat, watch another movie. And he'd driven for 3 days, took 3 days to drive from Montreal down to the southern tip of Florida. He had a week at the star party and he had 3 days to drive back. Oh my goodness. So it's nearly the same amount of time driving as he'd had, at the star party, so yeah. So although I think I go a long distance, I don't have an unpleasant journey, but because it's so touristy, because people are on the spring break, there's plenty to do for food and stuff around there, so you can try a 20-minute drive into the town to go and grab a bite to eat and stuff. And they've got a vendor on site, a little sort of kitchen. You can grab a burger or a coffee or something like that as well.
So, did you rent a car, Mark, or what did you do for transport?
Yes, got a rental. So I pick it up in Miami at the airport, and then it's a 3 hour drive down to the Keys. And then, of course, I've got somewhere to put all my stuff. So during the day, I don't want to, if you wouldn't lose stuff, if the weather's bad, if it rains or something, at least you can chuck all your stuff in the car. It's kept secure. It's out of the weather then. But yeah, I do find it strange coming from England because, of course, one of the strict rules of the Star Party is that you're not allowed to bring your firearm onto the Star Party.
Yeah, that's
And I
something
keep
we're
on
not used
thinking,
to.
yeah, why would you want to bring a firearm to a Star Party? But I guess some people do.
I noticed that in your setup there, that first photo you were showing us with your 90mm Megrez and the Skywatcher AZ GTI, you had the battery pack strapped to it. How do you fly with a battery pack like that? Do you have to check it special, take carry on?
Well, no, you can look up what the rules are for how you fly with a battery pack. And I can't remember what it is. It's like 160 watt hours or something like that. That's the rule. That's what to yeah, because you're allowed to fly with people use it to charge your laptop or charge
Yeah.
your phone. And as long as you're below that, whatever that maximum weight is or watt hours of lithium, you're allowed to fly. So I looked up what the maximum was. I think it's like 160 watt hours. And then just bought the next one down, which is a Tannat cell battery pack. And then just, I can't, you've got to carry it hand luggage. You can't put it in the hold because if the fire breaks out in the hold, they can't deal with it. So you've got to put it in your hand luggage.
Oh, okay. Well,
And yeah, you always get to meet the security guards at the airport who are into photography.
yeah.
So, yeah.
Very cool.
So how many
Did you buy?
people would you say were there, Mark, over
It's
the
a few
course of the
hundred
week?
people,
Few hundred, hey?
300, maybe 400 people, I'd say in total. And so
Yeah.
not a lot, but
Yeah.
certainly a lot more than, in my local clubs meetings, we'll get tens of people. So it is a much bigger event. Yeah, and there's people from all over the world. I mean, I've obviously come from England. There's other people from Europe as well. People from all over North America, all the states, Canadian provinces as well. So it's a really good turnout, and it is, and you're surrounded by people who are into astronomy. Yeah, everyone's passionate about it. Everyone's looking at different things. There's solar observing during the day. There's people looking at the moon, the planets, deep skies, imaging. There's visual observing. So it's a tremendous sense of camaraderie. It's great fun. You do two, I did an hour or two of observing by myself. I'd take a break, I'd walk around, kind of look at some of the big dobs, some of the imaging setups, go and do another 2 hours of observing, go and grab a coffee with someone, maybe finish at 3 or 4 in the morning, everyone's getting tired, maybe the Milky Way is starting to rise. So you just sit there on your deck chair looking at watching the Milky Way rise through binoculars. So yeah, it's a really good fun event. Thoroughly recommend it.
Yeah, it
And
sounds
especially as
amazing.
it's in, sorry, yeah, especially as it's in February, with the sort of gray skies.
Yeah, it's nice for us anyway, or my preference is in the wintertime, if possible, to try to get somewhere warm for at least a week. It just helps break up the long winter, and on top of that, it helps. Like, I wouldn't say I get sort of miserable, but when I'm not doing astronomy, I sort of start to get agitated. So, to be able to fit that in during the winter time is really a cool option. This Star Party has been on my list for a while, but I think if we flip the calendar 12 months, there's a good chance I'll be in Florida because I do want to attend this one.
Oh, awesome. No, it is good. Don't really recommend it.
Yeah, for
And I
sure.
like this picture as well. So we actually had a rare clear sky. I'm just going to share the screen again. So the end of February, we had some clear skies, and there was a really bright full moon. Does that come now through to you?
Yep, we can see it.
So I think this was on the 23rd. Yeah, 23rd of February. The moon was pretty much full. So it was 98% full moon. And I always find it strange because people say, never look, yeah, it's no point looking at the moon when the moon's full because, there's no point digging in deep sky observing because the moon washes out all the faint fuzzies. And there's nothing to see on the moon anyway because it's full. But I don't know, in my experience, there's always a terminator somewhere, unless there's a lunar eclipse, there's always a terminator. And this time, the moon's south pole of the moon was actually tilted towards us, the libration effect. So you could actually see down towards the south pole. So you had all this stuff that you don't really normally see because it's over the limb, but it's tilted towards us. But you've got this crater here, Malapart, and you've got these mountains. These are the peaks of eternal light. these are the ones where they want to build the lunar bases, the Artemis lunar bases, because the peaks are always illuminated as the moon rotates. These mountains are so tall and near the South Pole that the summits are always got sunlight. And then the floors, the crater floors, this is where they've got all the frozen water, where you have all this cometary asteroid impact and it's sort of blown all the water across the surface. And of course, it's all been baked away where the sun gets to it. But because you've got these deep valleys and deep clefts at the background, you've actually got frozen water sort of trapped in there, these sort of permanently shadowed regions. And they have the Odysseus space lander, the one that landed at the end of February.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember the Intuitive machines landed at the South Pole of the Moon? And it landed just there. So I was actually the day after they landed, I was actually imaging their landing site at the same time. So that was quite cool. I mean, so the reason why they landed there is that it's a precursor for the Artemis missions, and that's because they want to capture, explore all the geology of these mountains and crater floors as well ahead of the Artemis missions.
Yeah, very neat. Is this the same Player One camera that you were using at the Winter Star Party?
Yes. So because it's black and white.
Yep.
On the moon, it works really well because it is mostly black and white. So yeah, nice wide field of view. But this is on the big telescope. This is on my C11 in the Garden Observatory. So yeah, at home, I've got the C11, and then use the refractor, the little 90 millimeter refractor, as my sort of grab and go setup, go traveling telescope. Yeah, I was really quite enthused by this picture, so I'm really pleased to share it with you. So you've got these mountains, right out on the South Pole with a limb. All these rims, and apparently that's the rim of an ancient impact basin. There's on the far side of the moon, and it's called the Aitken Impact Basin, and these mountains are just the very edge of it from what we can see from the Earth.
Yeah, I
Those aren't,
appreciate. Oh, go
I was
ahead,
going to
Chris.
say they're not very creative mountain peak names, M4 and M5.
Yeah, maybe we should come up with some better names. I'll call one Chris and one Shane or
Oh, there you go.
something.
Or maybe they could just be called the two knobs or something like that.
Yeah, that works too. Probably more fitting. I appreciate what you said, Mark, though, about the moon. And I'm certainly guilty of it. Like when it's anywhere near full, I don't think to look at the moon. And B, I certainly don't think of doing any deep sky observing. But I appreciate your comment that there's always a Terminator, almost always, right? And there's always if there's that sort of contrast, then you have something to look at there. How visible, so that photo was fantastic. How visible is that visually, or is that an unfair question? I'm just curious.
You can see it. Yeah, it's a high power view. So I've got the times two Barlow in, so I've boosted up the magnification. But yeah, you definitely see them. I mean, the very fact they've got crater names means they were obviously mapped, in the 1700s, 1800s when all these craters were given their names. So yeah, very visible, easily visible, not easily visible, but what I find interesting is I quite enjoy looking at the moon and observing the moon, but you only get to see it, several times a year because of the libration effect. So often, so if you came back 6 months' time, it'll be the North Pole of the Moon that's well placed, and the Southern Pole will be on the other side. So it's a limiting, you only get to see it occasionally.
With planetary and lunar astrophotography, so going back a little bit here, you said the 90 millimeter turns into a 20 inch with the camera and longer exposures and stacking. When it comes to planetary and lunar, is aperture more important, using the C11 as opposed to say the 90 millimeter, or is
Yeah, the
aperture
physics.
still a
Yeah,
little
the
less?
physics still works that way in that resolution is proportional to aperture. So if you double your aperture, you double your resolution. Or I think that's what it works out, isn't it? If you do your Nyquist sampling, I'm thinking back to physics and engineering now, isn't it? Your sampling rate. So yeah, so if you have a bigger telescope, you have better resolution. Now, what was I found interesting? So for example, one of the guys set up near us in at the Winter Star Party had an 8-inch refractor, and we were looking at Jupiter through his telescope, and it wasn't until I went to Florida and I realized what good seeing was, and in the sense that there was no seeing because Jupiter was just still. And even in an 8-inch, which is not a big telescope, obviously a refractor is a nice instrument to have, there's no central obstruction. that through an 8-inch telescope, you could see the different sizes of Jupiter's moons. You know, Io was a small orange disk. Yeah, Europa was a creamy white. Ganymede was slate gray. And you can just see it. It's just dead still. So the downside, and certainly being up here in northern England, sorry, in the northern hemisphere, up at 51 degrees north in southern England, is we often get the jet stream overhead. And if the jet stream's overhead, you've got turbulence in the atmosphere, and it doesn't matter how good your telescope is, whether it's a refractor or a reflector, how big or small it is, if you've got turbulence in the atmosphere, you're limited by how much you can resolve, no matter how good your processing skills, how good the optics are. So aperture is important, but the seeing conditions tells you what you can see. But when, you know, so I think about to say Mars 2020, we had a really nice autumn, fall weather, and night after night, it was clear blue skies, yeah, hazy sort of skies. And the scene was really good. We had this nice high pressure built up over sort of the North Atlantic, over Northern Europe. And yeah, you could resolve on Mars, you know, some of the craters, you know, with the C11, you could see the volcanoes, you know, the Tharsis volcanoes on Mars. And, you know, that's with an 11-inch telescope. So if I went out 2 or 3 weeks later, when the storm, when that weather had pattern had changed and we had the stormy weather, it was just a blurry mess. So resolution helps you so much. Yeah, sorry, aperture, sure. Which is proportional to resolution, helps you so much.
Yeah.
And that's why they build telescopes, you know, not up here in Northern Europe. They build them, you know, in the Canary Islands or Hawaii, you know, where you've got those good stable air patterns.
Yeah, for sure. The 8-inch refractor, was that an iSTAR, or do you know who made that one?
It was a Tech. So really nice. I mean, there's no way I could have carried that in my hand luggage. Because it was looked like a bazooka, you know, a rocket launcher.
You almost need a trailer for something that large. Yeah.
That was good.
So what were some of the, so you mentioned the 32-inch, huge, incredible, and 8-inch refractor is also pretty incredible to me. What were some of the other interesting telescopes that you maybe had an opportunity to look at, or even better, to look through?
Oh, well, one of the best, have you seen the, I did an interview with him of the, that big blue planetary Newtonian. Have you seen that one on the Refreshing Views?
Yeah, I watched YouTube that. Page? That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So there's a chap who's he's a very keen lunar and planetary observer called Bruce, and he's built this. He's got a 12-inch F8, 12.5-inch F8 Newtonian. Huge thing, you know. I mean, imagine it's an 8-foot, 10-foot long tube.
Wow.
And it is just amazing, you know. And he's really optimized the sort of optical performance of the tubes blocked, tiny secondary. He's got thermal cooling as well, and the views are just amazing. You know, it's a really nice. It's like looking through a refractor. You know, but just the diffraction spikes coming off the brighter stars. But again, you know, he had it set up. He had a nice binocular view in there, and when you're looking at, say, because Jupiter's really high, Jupiter's overhead. You know, the telescope's looking straight up, so you've got to go up the ladder, and you're looking through the binocular viewer. And you know, I would normally say, "Oh, I can see the great red spots." But of course, there I could see details inside the great red spots through that one. That was quite cool. That was a 12-inch. But we had an 8-inch refractor near us. That was the Tech. Had a 28-inch tracking Dobsonian as well. That was catching all this exotic stuff. It's, you know, the 24-inch next to it, everyone was going to the 28. It's funny, isn't it? You know, 24-inch. Oh, that was the small one. People were walking past that.
I call that spoiled.
Yeah.
So I'm also a little bit of a nerd when it comes to like older vintage telescopes. Were there any classics there that you noticed?
Not that I noticed, but yeah, I'm just trying to look back through my notes. Yeah, you had your standard obsessions, those sort of things in terms of classics and refractors. Now, there was one thing that's quite here. This would be interesting to get your thoughts on. One of these new SMART telescopes. Have you seen these? The one guy had the C-Star next to us when they said WAC stars.
Yeah. And I haven't seen one in person, but we've received multiple emails from folks that have bought and are using them, and they seem really really cool. Like, you know, just out of the box, you know, kind of set it up, run it through whatever alignment and then let it do its thing while, like a lot of our listeners that have written us, set up the C-Star, you know, beside their other telescope. So the C-Star is doing the imaging and then they either do more imaging at their primary scope or they do visual over there. So I'm very intrigued by them.
Yeah, it does. And it was really incredible. I mean, I think back to learning to observe and, you know, trying to find things in the pair of binoculars and star hopping and which way round you hold star charts and stuff. And all that learning, gatekeeper, whatever you want to call it, those barriers that you have to come to push through just aren't there, you know, and let alone learning to do image processing and stretching and stacking. The software does it all for you. I was really impressed with it, you know. So he got it up and running, literally just put it down and was, you know, capturing multiple images of Eta Carina, for example. And then during the day, you put the solar filter on and it just works. You know, you're not having to do your three. You know what it's like. You say, so for example, my Skywatcher, the GTI, you have to type in your latitude and longitude, or you have to look it up on your phone, and it says, right, find three stars, Sirius, Rigel, I don't know, Regulus or something like that. And if you're learning, you're like, well, I don't know which ones those are. You know, you've got to get your star charts out and you've got to find out which ones they are. Can I see them? Yeah. So, and of course, it just does it. You know, the C-Star, the clever bits in the software, that user experience.
Yeah, you know, and I appreciate your comment there about learning the night sky and this removes that barrier. And I think some astronomers almost view that as a rite of passage that you must learn the night sky. And I think it's important, but I must say, you know, since I've gotten the digital setting circles on my primary setup, I can't believe how much more observing I do, which is really the point of the whole exercise to me, because I'm spending less time looking at star charts, star hopping, maybe going left when I should have went right, you know, wasting time, and using some of the technology just to sort of augment or again, remove the barrier. As you said, it really has been I love it. I just absolutely love it. And, you know, using technology in that regard, it's minimally invasive for me anyway, in my process. And it just really enhances my whole session, really.
I was trying to think how many, so people like you, you're hardcore observing anyway, you know what I mean? No matter what the barriers are, you are going to go observing. And I do wonder how many more people who have bought, you know, what we call, you know, there's all sort of department store telescopes, you know, that a 50 millimeter refractor that can go up to times 600 on a wobbly mount that you can't work out how to use. How many people must that have those sort of setups put off astronomy? It's just no point doing it. It's really hard. And then, yeah, compare that with the C-Star, which just works. I do think it is it going to be like a gateway? Do you think it'll be like a gateway telescope? You know, that, oh, I really like this. Now I'm going to learn the constellations. I'm going to, you know, look at the moon and the planets and do all the other types of astronomy, you know, because you haven't been put off. It's whetted your appetite. It's now enthused you to go and do that. So I do hope it's a gateway telescope and maybe encourages people to, well, okay, now I know more about the night sky and about imaging and what to look at. You know, I'm now going to get a telescope and a mount and do my own approach. And they're only $500. I know they're not big telescopes, but for $500 to have a mount with software, with filters, with a telescope, with a focuser, that's not too bad, I thought.
You know, I think it's phenomenal. Yeah. Like, you know, not only is it, like you said, it just works. It's very simplistic and it, you know, functions the way you would want it to. The price point is, I think, incredible. Like they've basically removed, I think, just about all the barriers. They make it easy to, you know, image. The price is very reasonable, I think. And the quality, I think, surpasses what I would expect from a unit like that. So, yeah, I think it's fantastic.
I was chatting to a guy, you know, and he said, well, what do you, you know, when someone comes up to you and says, oh, you're into astronomy, I want to get my kids a telescope, you know, because he wants to do astronomy at night sky. And you're thinking, do I recommend them a small refractor, you know, on a little telescope, on a little mount? But you then got to learn the constellations, what you're looking at. So it's good enough for looking at the moon and a bright star or something like that. Whereas with this, for roughly the same amount of money, you've got such a more capable setup. So I was really impressed by it. It's almost like a sort of paradigm shift. It's such a different approach, you know, compared to, what we can do. And it's doing roughly the same thing that I'm doing in that live stack. Instead of viewing it on a laptop screen, you're viewing it on your phone or your tablet. He had that on his iPad or his tablet or something. So, and he just sat there, just watching the image build up, and, right, what do I want to look at now? I don't know. This is really interesting. I'm going to have a look at this. So, I was quite impressed with that. That was one of the most interesting, thought-provoking setups there. Ironically, the smallest. It's only about a foot tall.
Yeah. Was there many of those at the Winter Star Party?
One or two, I think, but there was a chap near us who had that one. So he showed me his setup, so I recorded that. So if you want, again, that's on the Refreshing Views YouTube as well, is there as well. So yeah, so a real variety of setups. There was imaging setups near us, big dobs, refractors, and again, yeah, the smart telescope, which is the first time I've ever seen one in action, and it did get me thinking. Back to, I think, being given a small 50mm refractor when I was about 10 or something, and just not knowing how to use it. It just did not work. I couldn't find things in it, couldn't focus on it. I think I saw the moon a handful of times and that was it. And yet he was having a blast, with this 50mm sea star.
Yeah, I think they're really, really neat. How long is the Winter Star Party? How many days is it again?
It's a week.
A
So it
week,
starts on the Monday morning. And then you pack up Sunday evening.
Yeah, this sounds like a great option. Every time we talk about this, or I hear about the Winter Star Party, my brain starts turning all sorts of things to, see how I see how I can make it work in my calendar.
Yeah, you got to go for it. You got to go for it. Because there's one year I didn't go, which I think was 2019 or something like that. So I didn't go 2019. I thought I must go in 2020. And that was February 2020. And there was that cruise ship was stuck off the coast of Japan and they were trying to get the passengers ashore, but the Japanese government wouldn't let them in because they all had COVID. Mm-hmm. And 2021, you couldn't travel. 2022, you couldn't travel. So 2023, 2024, I said, yes, I'm going for it.
Yeah.
So you never know what's happening around the corner. You've got to seize the moment.
100%.
I tried to plan for it this year, but coming from here, it's the flights are strange. Like, you can't book before mid-November or something like that. So I was looking to see if I could book a flight, but I couldn't even really get a flight from Saskatchewan. You had to fly to some far off distant lands to make your way down there. It would have been easier to drive almost. But apparently the flights come live here at the end of November for the end of January, beginning of February to Florida. So I didn't know that. But so I kind of missed the boat on that one. Because I figure if I didn't book that far ahead of time, I'm going to be paying a fortune for the flights. But they just don't even put them available until much closer to the dates than I would have imagined.
Yeah, it looks like you're in your observatory there, Chris, with your background there. How's the observatory these days?
It's coming along. Nothing the past 2 or 3 months just because of winter, but it's getting there. Still need to finish sorting out the pier, power, and a few other little things like that. But probably I'm thinking end of June. That's sort of my timeline. I'm hoping that it can be finished by the end of June, just because spring here is a wet and slimy affair, so it can take a while for things to dry out, and there needs to be an additional support put into the pier to hold the 7-inch refractor, so that's gonna happen.
7-inch anyway. Refractor.
Yeah, I bought a 7-inch.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I bought a seven.
That's just a grab and go, is it now?
Yeah. I was talking to Mike about it last time, our buddy Mike, and it's a bit heavier than my current scope. So yeah, so that's got to go in there, and it's going to need a little bit of a reinforcement on the pier before it goes in there. So, but if you recall, I was originally planning to put a C11 in there like yours, and have a very similar setup to yours, but there's no point in us having a similar setup. I got to go for something original.
You got to be different, haven't you? Yeah, put a little sea star on the end of it.
Yeah. No, I don't think I'm getting one of those anytime soon. Yeah. But the one thing, and I talked to my builder about this, that I like about your observatory is you have that little office room on it.
Oh, the little warm room. Yes.
Yeah. That would have been pretty sweet. And my observatory is on a hill like yours. And I, man, it would have been so nice to have something like that. I guess nothing precludes me from having it in the future, but I would definitely be in violation of a few building codes doing that out there, I think. So it might be, that might be one that they wouldn't overlook. I don't know. So, but
that's great. You can, you got a place to keep all your accessories, you know, you can write up your notes the next day. Where else are you going to put your 3D printer? You know, that's all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, but yeah, I know I put a desk in it. So there's a desk in there and chart table and all kinds of good stuff like that. So we got to put in some, I'm going to put it, what do you use to hold your eyepieces in your observatory? Do you have like little shelves or something, or just that old IKEA?
Yeah, I got one of those IKEA, what do you call it? Chest of drawers sort of thing. So it's got, it's, I don't know, 1 foot by 1 foot sort of footprint, but about 5 foot tall. And it's got little drawers and cupboards and stuff like that. So when I'm using them, they all go in there. There's one section that's open, so I can put them in there. Because, of course, if you leave them out, you're then exposing the lens to the colder deep space, to all the damp and the dew. So I put it in the little cupboard, and that keeps the worst of the cold and the frost off them.
Yeah, I'm thinking about putting in like some 2x4s into the walls, just because the walls are 2x4 studded. And if we put some, crosses in there, then I can stack them in, in and amongst the shelves. But one of the listeners wrote me with a neat idea. I looked at it briefly. Was you can buy like a dew heater, but it's like a heating plate. I think it's for laptops or something, and you can put your eyepieces on that. But
yes,
I think it was about $300 Canadians.
Well, I have seen people who buy, you get your eyepiece case, whatever that consists of. Some people have belly cases. Some people have like a nice wooden case, like Shane's got in the background. And then just get a dew heater. A 2-inch eyepiece dew heater, what are they, 20, 30 bucks or something like that? Just put that in, have a little limiter switch. So when you can put it on and off. And then when you put your eyepieces in, it keeps them nice and warm because you shut the lid.
That's kind of what I'm thinking. That's because I have like these big cases. Shane, actually, he built mine. But I was thinking I could just drop in one of those little inexpensive dew heaters that you can get from a variety of manufacturers, and putting one of those in probably would do the trick, I would imagine.
Yeah. I used to use those little chemical hand warmers, which you put inside your gloves.
Oh, that seems risky because that stuff tends to leak.
No, I didn't have a problem with it. You're right, that could be a risk, but I didn't have a problem with mine. And I would just crack the little coin thing that's inside it, chuck it in, and that gives, 2 or 3 hours worth of warmth, so for a quick session.
Yeah.
Keep that would be enough to keep it warm. But I like the idea of a heating pad, because people use them for their pets or something, don't they?
That could be good too. But I need to kind of sort out quite a few things, like dew heaters for it, because wind is a bit of a problem out here, as Shane even mentioned at the start of the podcast. And so of course, once you block the wind, you remove your dew inhibitor. So the observatory just fills full of dew at night. But I have ways to mitigate it, but I think I need to get some dew heaters and that sort of thing. But I think it's more easily dealt with than the wind is, that's for sure, because the wind here is just so brutal. So
nice being able to duck down behind the walls, isn't it, Cindy?
Oh yeah,
I can hear that sometimes when I'm in the shed, and I can hear the wind, I can hear the trees rushing back and forth in the wind, and I go, that's not that bad down here, under the wind.
Oh yeah, exactly. I was out there in end of December, beginning of January, and it was minus 13, it was minus 18, minus 20, something like that with the wind. And
oh my goodness,
I was looking at something, and I went down, I said to my wife, because it was still early, because it's dark here at 5 o'clock at that time of year, I said, you should come up and take a look at how this all works in the observatory. And we're like walking up the hill, and she's like, I don't know how long I can be out here because it's just that wind. And I said, no, just come in. And then she came in and she hung out for half an hour, 45 minutes. So that's about her duration and patience with it anyway. But that just goes to show, like, if there was no walls blocking that wind, you could maybe be 5-10 minutes, it's just brutal. But that's really the main the main bit for having the observatory is just permanent setup out of the elements like wind. And then when the rain clouds do get on the horizon, you can just roll it up and lock it down. Takes about 3 minutes to lock it down. It's so weird though. I'm sure you experienced this. I'm curious if you experienced this as well, Mark, when you first get your observatory and you got it running and you had all your gear in there and then you observe and all you do is roll up. Do you feel like you're like walking away and forgetting something kind of thing because you don't have to go and drag everything in at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever?
Yeah, I know what you mean because yes, if I get fatigued or it's time to go in and the weather's turned and you say, you put the dust caps on, roll the roof back, latch it down. And I think, and I'm like, well, there's got to be something else I got to do. This used to take 25 minutes to pack it all the way. And so that was a real pleasure. My one worry is that I leave the mount on and I leave the mount tracking, go to bed, and of course it'll then, the telescope will slew round and hit the pier or rip a cable out.
Yeah.
So that's my big fear. So I do have a little checklist that I have. I've printed out a little checklist, you know, mount power, put it in the home position, latch it down, put the dehumidifier on. So I just work my way down my checklist and then I can go to bed. Because I get into bed and I get into trouble because, you know, I'm cold when I get in. And so my wife will tell me off and, you know, you sit there and think, oh, did I turn the mount off? I can't remember turning the mount off. So I had to get dressed again, go outside, check the mount. And I find I have turned it off, but I completely forgot about it. And I had to get back into bed and get told off a second time. So having a checklist by the front door, by the observatory door, to work it down, do your shutdown procedure, especially when you're tired in the small hours.
What I'm going to do, this might seem excessive because I too experienced that, and I'm actually going to get a breaker installed. So that I can throw the breaker from like down below without having to go back to the observatory. Yeah. So I'm just going to put it by basically by the bathroom and just like throwing a switch. Yeah. I think that's probably the best thing to do for a whole pile of reasons. I was doing another call earlier this week with a person I know. I was getting advice from him as well for observatories because he's built 4 or 5 of them, I think. And he told me that he had strung a cable once and forgotten about it. And remembered just as the plow started plowing his driveway at like 3 o'clock in the morning. And of course he had the cable strung across the road. And anyway, it ripped the cable all up, but fortunately it didn't pull it the wrong way and pull everything over inside the observatory. So things can get pretty messy pretty quick, but.
Especially in the dark when it's cold and you're sleepy, you know, that's the hassle, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even like Mike came out one night and we couldn't get it running because the cable was, there's like 2 cables we have run out there. Of course, the middle one was unplugged. It was just like, it took us like 10 minutes to figure this out in the dark, right? Normally in the daytime, this would be like 5 seconds, right? But in the dark, you just can't see, right? You just can't see anything. And yeah.
Now, for your kill switch, when you get like a pilot's like missiles, when you have like a little thing you've got to lift up to press the button, you know? Like
Yeah, it's going to be something like that. I don't know what it will look like exactly. I think my builder, that's actually something he thought of after we were chatting about this. But he's going to trench out a line up there in once the ground unfreezes, dries out, and has a little bit of time to settle. That can take about 6 or 8 weeks after melt. Then he's going to dig the line in and then dig out around the observatory pier a little bit more and pour in another 400 or 500 pounds of cement and put some steel bar in. And yeah, so
that'll hold it. That'll be, wouldn't it?
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. It's like never going to be ideal, but I mean, I'm running up to 150 power, no problem. Like that's fine. I just really want to run super high power. Like I'd like be able to get up to like 300 power without any vibration. And that's definitely, I mean, honestly, I've been in a lot of people's observatories. It's sort of about average right now, but I like power, you know, so should be good.
That's good. You'll be ready for Mars then. We've got Mars this autumn coming back again, so that'd be something cool to see.
Yeah, I think it's lower this time though, isn't it? And it's not as big.
It's higher for us up in the northern hemisphere,
but it's smaller.
a smaller disc. So what the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. So yeah, you'll be higher above all the seeing, but it's a smaller disc.
You know what I need though? If you ever see any, because you're a person who communicates with a lot of folks as well, and even for the listeners, I need a like the secondary scope holder for my AZ GTI, because the one that it came with was missing a bolt, and it's sort of a critical bolt that cannot be located or replaced easily, it turns out. And yeah, if you ever see one or know anybody that buys AZ EQ6.
Don't you work at the college or the university? Do they not have a machine shop?
This is, you have to take like the whole thing up. You have to like machine the screw. You need something to base it on. I don't know what you would base it on. Like you would need to have all the specs. I mean, if somebody, and I know somebody, one of the listeners, that we talked to quite a bit, and he was looking at his, and he's somebody that can machine things. And, even he was reluctant because you actually have to take, like if you look at your,
take the saddle apart.
You know how there's like two sides to it and it's sandwiched together and there's a bolt in the middle that goes through into your counterweight shaft.
Yes.
It's missing that bolt. And so you have to take those apart and then that could damage it. It's not really meant to be taken apart. It's just, this is like a critical piece that it's missing. And Skywatcher, they won't sell me the extra part. So,
oh no.
Yeah, I know. So I'm kind of, you're talking about Mars coming around there, and I really wanted to put my Takahashi 4-inch beside the 7-inch and be able to do the planets when that was in. But that's on hold while I see if I can get this. So I might not be able to run a second scope in there. I don't know. But
Good luck with that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a bit of a hassle. Yeah, if anybody out there has a solution to that. I thought this would be pretty easy to solve. I thought I would just be able to find a bolt or get one machine, like you said. I thought this won't be a big issue. I know a good machine shop, but yeah, they wouldn't touch this. And even listeners that are extremely handy, they were like, oh yeah, this won't be a problem. Then they went and looked, they were like, holy smokes. Yeah, you're better off just buying a new part. I can't get a new part. So that's my sob story.
Yeah. Gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah. Always problems with this stuff, hey?
Yeah. Yeah, the astronomy is the easy part, isn't it? The actual observing.
Yeah.
By the time you thought the weather, the equipment, the software, the setup, fatigue, work.
Yeah. We should probably conclude this one, though. I think we're getting on. Do you have anything to add, Shane, before we wrap her up?
No, just thanks for her coming on again, Mark. Always enjoy talking to you, and it was great hearing about the Winter Star Party.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. So, yeah, if you don't have to go to the Winter Star Party. There are other star parties, you know. So, you know, if your local club or the local society has a star party, I do recommend going for it. And, the beauty of the Winter Star Party, of course, as you said, it's in the middle of winter. You know, so you've got that to look forward to when everything else is grey and wet and horrible, and or in your case, cold and frozen. I do recommend star parties. If you're a beginner observer, yeah, it's a chance to see awesome kits. If you're a more experienced observer, you know, you get to see new objects and look through other telescopes as well. So thoroughly recommended star parties.
Cool. Thanks so much for joining us today, Mark. Be sure to check out Mark Radici's YouTube channel, which is, you can just find it by Googling Refreshing Views YouTube, or go to YouTube and just look up Refreshing Views. And please subscribe and share our show with other stargazers. You know, send us your show ideas, observations, and questions to actualastronomy@gmail.com.
Thank you everyone for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. If you are interested in more information, would like to contact us, or if you would like to support the podcast, check out our website, actualastronomy.com.